Thank you very much, Peggy. It is probably a unique, certainly a rare honour to be invited to give a lecture named after somebody without whom, as they say, you wouldn't be here. And that is absolutely true. Not only would I not be here, very likely I wouldn't be doing science, I'd be doing something rather different, because it was way back in 1982 that Sir David Wetherall, who I had been working for as a houseman, not my greatest strength, some of you will know, and I went into his office to ask him if I could work in his lab. So having got the words out, he looked gravely at me with the pipe still smoking, thought very hard, and asked me what I would like to do. This is absolutely true. And I then got a little bit more brash and I said I would like to make a malaria vaccine. After which many, many puffs followed. And soon through the clouds came the wise words, perhaps you better learn a little molecular biology first. So I learned molecular biology, I joined his lab, I had three of the best years of my life doing a DPhil under his supervision, chasing people around the Pacific. Well, not quite, but almost. My project was to look at thalassemia, as nearly everyone in the lab did, but luckily not in Saudi Arabia, as the previous student had got, but in Oceania, and in particular in somewhere that he called Vanuatu. So to echo his words, he said, would you be interested in working on Vanuatu? To which, without a moment's hesitation, I said, yes, that sounds ideal. I walked out of the office a few minutes later, paused, and thought, I've just agreed to spend 3 years of my life on somewhere I don't know where it is. And it got worse. I went downstairs to the Cairns Library in Level 3, got out the atlas, went straight to the index, and Vanuatu was not there. This, I remind you, was 1982, the archipelago, which, in case you still don't know, is right there, had just become independent from being called the New Hebrides and called itself Our Islands, or Vanuatu. And I set to work soon afterwards looking at the genetics of thalassemia there. This slide is really to let Sir David know that the quite extraordinary collection of samples that I was a very small part of putting together, now numbering about 17,000 DNA samples from the remotest parts of the Pacific, put together by John Clegg and himself to look at the causes of anemia there, these are still being very valuable. And people in my lab, particularly Alex Mentzer, who's here, and Tom Parks and others, have recently been doing some of the first whole genome sequences of these islanders. They're not in the main databases, as you can imagine, and we hope to be able to address some of the questions that I was interested in, well, 30 years ago, with much greater power and resolution by sequencing these individuals at a whole genome level from different islands. And this slide is just to really echo what Peggy said, that as well as working on vaccines, I have a lab at the Wellcome Trust Centre for Human Genetics that's very interested in genetic susceptibility to infection. I won't be talking about this today, but it's bacterial disease, as you can see on this slide. In diverse populations, we've done genome-wide association studies for all of these diseases and have interesting hits in all of those. And I'm sure in the longer term, this is going to be valuable in understanding differential susceptibility to these very, very important diseases. But today, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what goes on at the Jenner Institute, which we put together in 2005 from the ashes of an old institute called the Edward Jenner Institute for Vaccine Research. And it's rather unusual. This university doesn't readily or often do partnerships with external bodies. The body in this case being the Pirbright Institute in Pirbright in Surrey, which is the largest institute working on livestock research and vaccines in England. And we deliberately sought a partnership with Pirbright because we saw value in vaccine development for humans and other animals at the same time. Because the basic technologies, the preclinical research, if you like, in both fields, it's the same. We, of course, don't have a veterinary school, so we can't access that on our own in Oxford. But we try to, as you'll hear, develop innovative vaccines against a variety of different diseases. We will never sell a vaccine, so we have to partner with industry. And we drive what's called these days the One Health Agenda, developing drugs, vaccines, and diagnostics for humans and other animals at the same time. This is the new several hundred million pound building at Pirbright with biosafety level 4 facilities. So just to give you a glimpse on one slide of the range of activities at the Jenner Institute here in Oxford, we have vaccine candidates in development, not just for Ebola, which I'll talk about, but Helen McShane's program on TB, Ellie Barnes, Paul Kleinerman working on hepatitis C, Andrew McMichael and several other people, including Tom Hankey and others, developing HIV vaccines. All of these have gone to phase 2 trials, as you can see. Sarah Gilbert's work on a promising new pandemic flu vaccine. Andrew Pollard working on both meningitis and RSV. I'll talk about Ebola. And just in the last week, we have approval to start our first very ambitious vaccination program against prostate cancer. So all of these are linked by a very small number of common technologies. I'll talk about one in detail. But essentially, from a bird's eye view, what we are trying to do, you might describe, as cross the valley of death. We know these are difficult problems. There would be vaccines for them already if they were easy. We need new concepts, we need new ideas, we need new approaches to try and make a, say, an HIV vaccine. And we know that many of these will fail, probably the great majority, hence the valley of death. But somebody's got to do it, and rather annoyingly, or usefully if you're an academic, big pharma don't do this anymore. They leave it to biotechs, who increasingly find it difficult to fund, or to academics, who really have to break the ground and assess, not just preclinically, but also in humans, in phase 1 and 2 trials, the potential of new approaches before big pharma will even listen, certainly before they will buy in. So these are some concepts we've tested in recent years, and these are the really, really ambitious targets that we are after. And we have a couple of key technologies. We have only 2 arms, luckily, to the immune response, the antibody arm and the T-cell arm. We work on both, but we have a particular interest in T-cell induction, probably because we're fairly good at it. We use viral vectors for that. I'll talk a lot about those today. And for the antibody arm of the immune response, if you need really strong antibody responses, as we do in malaria and several other diseases, you're better off making a particulate moiety, a virus-like particle of about 20 nanometers in size, rather than a soluble protein, because dendritic cells and the immune system prefer to process these virus-like particles, as we call them, and they turn out to be better vaccines. So first to malaria, and I've been interested in malaria for a long time, as you've heard. It's still a huge problem. This is a photograph of a Gambian girl who I was trying to look after some 25 years ago in the Gambia. This is a disease that still kills about 500,000 African children every year. Total mortalities of the order of 750,000, most in young children, mostly in Africa. And just so you don't have to read too carefully the zeros here, this is 250,000,000 clinical cases, which we researchers sometimes likely call mild malaria, because you get better. If any of you have had mild malaria, you'll know it's not particularly mild. So that is a huge burden of morbidity. We're spending more money. This is the good news. $1.5 billion a few years ago. It's dropped in the last year or two for spraying drugs, particularly impregnated bed nets that work fairly well. But the real message today on this is that these are running out. The mosquitoes are becoming resistant to permethrin, which is in essentially all the bed nets. Spraying is very difficult in many places in Africa. Drug resistance, you know about from the work of Nick White and many other people. And all of these look as if they're going to last another 5 or maybe 10 years. And if we don't have anything new, malaria mortality is going to rise again. And just on the bottom line here, it points out that if we count not just what we're spending to control malaria, but what Africa is missing by having malaria, in other words, loss of economic growth per year, the number is even more problematic and enormous. This is my introductory slide on malaria vaccine research, just to remind some of you that it is not a new idea. These two brothers back in Algeria in 1909 were doing research on sporozoite vaccines for malaria in birds. Wisely, they spotted it wasn't really going to work and moved on to other important things, and we're still struggling with the problem a century later. Those of you who know the life cycle of malaria will realize that I've added one on here. There are usually three. There's pre-erythrocytic, which I've bundled, which people usually bundle together as the sporozoite stage and the liver stage. There's the blood stage, of course, which causes the disease and death. And then there are the transmission stages, with sex taking place rather bizarrely in the midgut of the mosquito. The reason it's in four parts here is that the vaccines that you would need to design and develop for a sporozoite, particularly an antibody-inducing vaccine, are fundamentally different to those that are needed to target a pathogen that has got inside a hepatocyte. In other words, liver stage malaria, and we work on those separately. I'll talk mainly about these two stages. It's what my group works on. But luckily in Oxford, we have excellent groups that I'll talk about at the end, working on blood stage malaria and mosquito stage malaria. And my guess is that at the end of the day, and that day is still a good 5 years away, we're probably going to have to put all of those components together to get a really highly effective, durable malaria vaccine. In other words, we aren't there yet. But there has been remarkable progress. About a year and a bit ago, GlaxoSmithKline put in for licensure, in other words, for approval by the European Medicines Agency, at least scientific approval, this first-generation malaria vaccine that is called RTS,S. Rather unusual name. I will explain to you why. Here we have the sporozoite stage of the life cycle. So we have female anopheline mosquitoes injecting these tiny sporozoites into the bloodstream, and very quickly, within minutes or hours, they go to the liver. If you can tackle them before they get into the liver with antibodies mopping them up and opsonizing them, then you have a fantastic vaccine that would prevent any sign of liver stage infection or blood stage infection. And that really is the most advanced vaccine in development. Luckily, on the surface of these sporozoites is predominantly one protein called the circumsporozoite protein. And if you take the gene for about half of that and fuse it to the hepatitis B surface antigen gene, you get RTS. RT is repeat T cell region surface antigen of hepatitis B. And then what they had to do some 25 years ago in SmithKline Beecham, as it was then, to express that complex protein was express an excess of the surface antigen protein, which is actually the vaccine many of you have had against hepatitis B. The reason was to form these virus-like particles I mentioned a moment ago, because those produce much stronger immune responses than just using, say, this protein alone. So it was a clever trick. It was very much ahead of its time in 1987. The problem is the vaccine's taken 30 years, pretty well, to get to where it is today, and it's not hugely effective. The reason we know that is because in malaria, unlike most diseases, we're allowed to give people the infection. We do this using coffee cups, small ones, with mosquitoes which are heavily infected inside. We give people precisely 5 mosquito bites. I know there are 6 on this slide, well counted. We do give them 5, and they all get malaria. Over 100 controls in our vaccine trials have been given 5 bites, and everyone has been infected. The breakthrough came with RTSS in that challenge model, as we call it, in the 1990s, and over the last 15 or so years, it has gone forward into a definitive phase 3 trial in Africa in over 15,000 infants and children, at 11 sites in 7 different countries, and the final results will be published coincidentally at 1 a.m. tomorrow morning in the Lancet. So congratulations to the organizers of this lecture and their timing. The results are, to be honest, a little bit mixed. So the group you want to vaccinate against malaria are babies. We vaccinate most of the babies in most of the countries in the world every day, probably 90-95%, with 10 different vaccines these days, including some recent pneumococcal vaccines that are very effective. That's a huge logistic achievement. It's also pretty expensive. So the problem for malaria is you have to vaccinate at those time points. Otherwise, it becomes incredibly complex and very expensive to vaccinate, say, at 7 months of age and 14. So we use 0 to 2, 3, and 4 months of age. This vaccine is targeted at 2, 3, and 4. And when you target that so-called expanded program on immunization age group of infants, the efficacy of the vaccine is about 30% in the first year. In other words, it roughly reduces malaria incidence by about 30%, which is not bad. Those are the curves of the rate of occurrence, cumulative incidence formally, of the malaria in the controls and in the vaccinees. And you can see straight away that most of the changes in the first 6 months, after that those lines are pretty parallel. And we now know that efficacy wanes very rapidly after 6 months. Short time span, about 26% efficacy against severe malaria, our best predictor of efficacy against malaria death. But the safety findings in this age group are not bad. So there's the dilemma. You have a vaccine that works partially for a while, and after about a year or two, it doesn't work at all, and there's some evidence of rebound in the new data that follow out to 4 years in tomorrow's paper. So what should we do? I think there'll be a lot of discussion. I think there may be some places it would be cost-effective to implement a vaccine with that level of efficacy and durability. But my real view on this is that it's a start. It's the first building block in a multi-component vaccine that we are aiming to develop that will be really cost-effective and will really save lots of lives from malaria in Africa and someday eradicate it. It won't be in the next 10 years, but it may well be in the next 30 years. Our contribution to this has been to redesign RTSS in a brash sort of way. We think we're designing it in, as R21, we call it, in the way that you would design RTSS today. We took the moiety with the malaria sequence, there it is, CS, fused to hepatitis B, used that and did not use the hepatitis B surface antigen alone, and managed to make this into a particle called R21, the repeat for the 21st century, and we're able to show that that is indeed a particle that looks covered with the malaria sequence, shown in this whatever color it is, green, brown, here, unlike RTSS, which is mainly covered with hepatitis B surface antigen. The trick was to produce it in a different strain of yeast called Pichia. We get very high immunogenicity in mice. We get 100% efficacy in mice. And we've struggled, to be honest, to make this, but finally have. This is the product made at our own GMP facility at the Churchill Hospital, and that should be in the clinic in the next couple of months. So we see that as an improvement on the existing leading RTSS vaccine. It remains to be seen whether it actually is better or not. But our main effort has been on the next stage of the life cycle, not the sporozoite going into the liver, but tackling the parasite while it's actually inside liver cells. And of course, to do that, you can't use antibodies. The antibodies can't get in. You need T cells. And of course, I was trained after Sir David's lab in Sir Andrew McMichael's lab, which was the leading, and probably still is the leading group, on cytotoxic T lymphocytes and their biology and how they function. And these days, we know a great deal of how to induce those in humans, which has been very difficult. The short answer is you need another virus. Modified Vaccinia Ankara, or MVA, I'll talk about a lot, we were able to show is a way of boosting CD8 T cells very powerfully in animals and in humans. Adenovirus, particularly simian strains that we use as vaccine carriers, are a very good way of inducing CD8 T cell responses. Yellow fever vectors or VSV vectors are newer ones that have more limited application. But in short, what we're trying to do is to get T cells that we induce by vaccination that circulate around in the blood to recognize a parasite-infected liver cell. That would, of course, in the case of a T cell, be through the HLA molecule on the surface of the liver cell, particularly presenting malaria peptides from inside the cell on the surface so they can be recognized by T cells. The problem is you need an awful lot of T cells circulating in the blood to clear every last liver cell, and that's been the main problem in the field. So a lot of what the group has done over the last 10 or 15 years has been first in animal models and later in clinical trials, work out ways of inducing more and more T cells, a higher concentration, if you like, in the blood that can more and more effectively tackle infected liver cells to try and clear malaria. This is our clinical candidate, an antigen called TRAP, which is on sporozoites and liver stage parasites. We broaden the immune response by putting in bits of other malaria antigens, as shown on the cartoon. And over 10 years of iterative small-scale phase 1 clinical trials worked out that this regime on this slide appears to be the best way of getting very high numbers of CD8 T cells. The trick is to use an adenovirus, which of course we all get infected by. We prefer not to use human strains because the immunity you get from infection blunts the vaccine response. We use chimpanzee strains, which are related but different enough not to be inhibited. And then a month or two later, we give the old smallpox vaccine, or a strain of it, that's very safe, modified Vaccinia ankara, encoding the same malaria antigen that we put into the adenovirus, so that we prime the immune response with the adenovirus, boost it with MVA, and get very high levels of T cell response. A lot of that was empirical, but some of it we understand pretty well today. The adenovirus induces the right pro-inflammatory signaling to induce CD8s from inside the cell. You need viruses inside the cell to get antigen processing onto class 1 molecules. And MVA, which expresses very, very rapidly inside cells, boosts before the induced immune response can clear it. And this slide just shows you that the Jenner Institute has used this technology a lot in not just malaria, but hepatitis C, HIV, flu, TB, RSV, Ebola, I'll come on to soon, and hopefully soon in prostate cancer. The numbers, I think, speak for themselves. I told you the difficulty is getting enough T cells. If you use old DNA vaccines, not very many. If you use MVA on its own, the same number. But if you prime with the chimpanzee adenovirus, which is pretty good on its own, and then boost with MVA, you're into thousands of T cells. So that's the favored regime. And slightly surprisingly, even though these are virus vectors that you get immunity to, in other words, to the virus itself, you can reuse the vector, say, a year later, and boost again and bring the T cell numbers back up to the peak you get at the start. For those of you interested in details of immunology, we get very heterogeneous populations of T cells, both the CD8s we want and the CD4s that probably help the immune response. They have diverse cytokines inside, sometimes just one, like gamma interferon, sometimes IL-2 and TNF. IL-2 may help the durability of the response. When we invite people to be bitten after being vaccinated, what we see is some partial efficacy. Around about 20-25% of people are sterilely protected. A lot more have delayed time to parasitemia, meaning we've killed most of the parasites in the liver, but not all. And the people who do best are those with the strongest CD8 T cell responses, measured here by flow cytometry. These are the sterilely protected people. So we have a mechanism that is working. It's just not working really well enough to clear the parasites fully in everyone. We think we can improve that. I'll describe a couple of ways we're working on at the moment and then move on to what we're doing in the field. If we knew the major antigen on the surface of the infected liver cell, remember there are hundreds if not thousands of malaria antigens, there are 5,000 genes being expressed inside that liver cell, we'd be able to put that into a vaccine. So we're trying to sequence those peptides eluted from HLA molecules. That's very much work in progress. But another technology has been really quite helpful just in the last year or so. One of the big problems working on malaria vaccines is human malaria doesn't infect mice. There are mouse malarias like Plasmodium bergii we use as models, and these days we can get the human malaria or falciparum antigens into those and use them as test beds, if you like, for vaccines with these collaborators. And to our slight surprise, and certainly we were pleased by this result, we found two other antigens called LSA1 and LSAP2 that in different strains of mice are much more protective than either TRAP or CSP, up in the 80-70% range rather than 0-30%. And we're going to move forward and use these two antigens in the next generation of candidate malaria vaccines. Another rather ambitious approach was to make the vaccine more powerful, more immunogenic, generating more CD8 T cells. And this is such a generally important question for cancer, for TB, for HIV, that the Gates Foundation some years ago gave us really quite a lot of money, even by their standards, to make better vectored vaccines by putting adjuvants into the viral vector. Now, some of you will have
be familiar with alum as an adjuvant, which you mix in with a vaccine. Here the idea is different. Take a cytokine, say IL-7, and put in not just the gene for malaria into the vector, but also the cytokine, and see if that works. So the short answer is it does, but very rarely indeed. And only in one of those 73 that we screened, which is the gene for the invariant chain, did we see a very big difference. You can encode this fused in frame with your malaria antigen and get much stronger CD8 T cell responses, for example, in non-human primates, in macaques. There's the adenovirus. After the MVA boost, you have two different colors here. The dark squares shown down here are with the new adjuvant and down here without. So you can increase the response about fourfold. That is a self-antigen. We're not happy vaccinating people with that. So in the lab, we've been looking at ways of dealing with that, taking short fragments of the antigen and using the same antigen from a different species, what we call xenogenization, to induce better responses fully, safely. And Ben Halberth, who's in the audience, has been leading on that work in the lab. In addition, we've been addressing the really quite important question of whether we could use these live viruses that we have really pioneered as a prime boost regime, not just in volunteers in Oxford, not just in healthy adults, but in young infants in Africa who need a malaria vaccine. And the only way to show safety is to do the clinical trials, and luckily we've been funded to do that in Gambian and Kenyan adults, then in children and infants in the Gambia, and we now have our first efficacy data from some of those trials. Very importantly, over 1,000 people have now been vaccinated in 6 countries, a couple in Europe, 4 in Africa, adults, infants and children. No safety concerns, no serious adverse events, a well-tolerated safety profile. And just in the last few weeks, we've vaccinated one-week-olds. We've vaccinated 6 months, 4 months, 2 months, and now one-week-old children with the adenovirus. Safety looks fine and immune responses are being measured. But this is our target population. In adults, of course, we can test efficacy fairly quickly. Here's a design with a single dose of adenovirus, a single booster dose of MVA, done at the Kemri Welcome Unit in Kilifi, led by Philip Bijon and his colleagues. And you can see that we compared the malaria vaccine to a rabies control vaccine, cleared everyone after vaccination of their parasites by drug treatment, and then followed them to see who got malaria. And rather encouragingly, the efficacy in this trial, which is now in press, was 67%, which surprised our competitors because we were only getting 25% in the volunteers in Oxford. Why would it be higher in the field? Well, we are not sure, but one contributor is surely the fact that you tend to get one mosquito bite in the field, you get 5 in the trials in Oxford. So maybe this is a more realistic example of what we'll get in the field. We'll find out fairly soon. So in summary, on malaria vaccines targeting the liver stage, we've got some efficacy correlating with the CD8 T cell number that we can induce. And that actually is the first example of getting CD8 T cells to protect anyone against any infectious disease. Safety looks okay so far in diverse populations, and we're beginning to see the first evidence of efficacy in the field. Now, the obvious thing, at least to me, to do, once you've got some partial efficacy at the liver stage and you have RTSS at the sporozoite stage, is to put the two of those together. And luckily, we're now able to work closely with GSK, and that combination vaccine approach, if you like, is going forward and is in clinical trials here in Oxford. So in summary, on pre-erythrocytic vaccines, they have shown the most efficacy, certainly compared to blood stage vaccines or others. Both RTSS and the vectored vaccine approach we've been developing are now showing encouraging efficacy in most people on sporozoite challenge through rather different mechanisms. And we certainly hope that we'll be able to improve the rather modest efficacy that RTSS has been showing in the field by adding in our liver stage component. But I mustn't finish on malaria before telling you that there are now several group leaders on malaria vaccine development in Oxford. This is Simon Draper, who's leading the blood stage work, has just been this week elected a Wellcome Senior Fellow. Shumi's group works on transmission stages. Arturo is also Wellcome funded and working on vivax malaria, another important problem. I'll just show you one slide on Simon's progress. He's been doing fantastically in developing a vaccine based on a new conserved blood stage antigen called RH5, certainly the most promising blood stage candidate, I believe. Lots of Nature papers here describing its identification, its ability to induce cross-neutralizing antibodies that cover all strains, very difficult at the blood stage, its recognition of red cells through the Basagen gene, the first vaccine to induce heterologous strain challenge efficacy in monkeys, and most importantly, phase one trials now underway in Oxford with viral vectors and with a protein inadjuvant approach next year. So, summing up on malaria, we've, out of four, probably giving two to the RTSS vaccine, maybe halfway to what we'd like that to do. Liver stage, so showing some promise, coming along afterwards. And these two stages really much more difficult. Transmission blocking sexual stage vaccines really at an early stage. And blood stage, RH5 apart, has been very, very difficult. But to cheer us all up just at the end, this is really the highest level of efficacy we've seen. And this is not bad if we could do this in the field. Putting RTSS and our viral vectors together, last year we saw 82% sterile efficacy in a first combination trial, 72% at 6 months, so that's really rather encouraging. And a rather new approach of injecting the whole parasite gave 76% at 3 weeks, lesser efficacy at 6 months. But I think some combination of these approaches is going to give a good vaccine in not very soon, but in the next few years. So I think malaria vaccination is possible. The problem, in a sentence, is that you need exceptionally strong immune responses to do with one vaccine or one antigen what nature does with immune responses to hundreds of antigens. We call this unnatural immunity because the immune responses RTSS induces or our viral vectors induce are never seen naturally in the field. Even if you spent your life getting infected by malaria, they just don't develop that immunity in endemic areas. Keeping the durability of protection remains a major issue. We may need to keep boosting, and different vaccine types may be suited to different settings and different aims. So that is one of the most difficult vaccines you could hope to try and develop. I'm going to move on to a vaccine rather briefly that I think is easy to develop. We have some evidence of that. And that frankly should have been developed and wasn't when this outbreak happened 7 months ago. So Ebola. Ebola virus disease is caused by this extraordinary filovirus. I knew nothing about filoviruses on the 1st of August last year. And rather embarrassingly, Jeremy Farrar and the WHO phoned me up on the same day and said, could you please do a trial of Ebola virus vaccines now, if possible? So it was a rapid learning curve. You all know about the outbreak in West Africa. It says 2014, it really started, probably the first case, back at the end of 2013. And I would put this virus in the category, certainly from a vaccine perspective, of outbreak pathogens. And the point that I'll come back to at the very end is this is not the only outbreak pathogen that we are ill prepared for. I'll come back to that. Firstly, a One Health perspective, Ebola just doesn't just decimate human populations, it wipes out troops of chimpanzees and gorillas. There are actually people, or were people, developing vaccines for gorillas, testing them in zoos in America a year or so ago. But for humans, this is a disease first described in 1976. Remarkably, two outbreaks in the same year in different countries, Sudan and Zaire, of the same strain of a hitherto unknown virus. These are the two common strains, the two you'd want to vaccinate against. It says case fatality rate over 50%. Rather grimly, we now know pretty exactly what that is. It's about 72%. Transmitted, of course, by human contact, body fluids. This is a hemorrhagic disease, causing a lot of diarrhea as well. But generally controlled by isolation measures, even in some of the poorest parts of the poorest countries in the world, like the Congo. There have been around about 30 outbreaks since. There was even a mini outbreak in the Congo while the huge outbreak was going on in West Africa last year. And the worry is that these things appear to be becoming more frequent, more severe. There was never one in West Africa until last year. And I don't see any reason why it should go down in frequency. The epidemic is mainly, of course, in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Declared a public health emergency only in August of last year, over 10,000 deaths by this month, and of course no vaccines licensed or developed, no drugs licensed, we were pretty well starting from scratch. Except that for a rather interesting reason, two vaccines not only had been worked on preclinically, but had been manufactured to GMP, ready for clinical testing, and they had been for a little while, and the clinical trials weren't even really scheduled. And the reason they existed at all was because of biodefense funding in the United States. These vaccines were being developed to protect Americans against an attack on America by some bioterrorist. So of course they were designed to cover multiple strains. There wasn't really a way forward to using them in Africa. That had to be developed rather quickly, and some prompt thinking was required. They were both viral vectors, a chimpanzee adenovirus, same technology I've been describing to you for malaria, and a vesicular stomatitis virus vector, almost unknown to all vaccinologists. It had been in two people in the world prior to last September. And this is just a map of how the epidemic was unfolding. This is weeks of last year from Chris Dry at WHO in about September. You can see why people began to panic around July, August, September, with cases starting in Guinea, spreading through Sierra Leone, and huge numbers in Liberia by September, and then the epidemic in Sierra Leone followed the huge bulge in cases in Liberia. So, briefly on the vaccines, this is the type of vaccine we ended up testing, an adenovirus, using a much simpler design. This virus has 7 genes, malaria has 5,000. It's fairly clear which one you'd produce if you were targeting antibodies. You'd go for the glycoprotein that sits on the surface of the virus, encode that in your adenovirus vector, and indeed, that was what was done. Even better, when that chimpanzee adenovirus, this time strain 3 rather than 63, with the Ebola virus Zaire strain, it's the Zaire strain that's in West Africa, in monkeys, induced very strong immune responses. This is as experimental design. What they did was they vaccinated the monkey, measured the immune response, not much of a design. There are the antibodies, there are the T cells, CD4s and CD8s, at pretty good levels of antibodies, and even better when you challenge these monkeys with a whopping dose of Ebola virus, that's the standard infection, 1,000 infectious units, you get 100% protection, either with the old adenovirus 5 vector or with the clinical grade chimpanzee adenovirus 3. If you ask how long does the protection last, well, at almost a year, it's down to 50%. But if you boost with MVA, you now know about MVA boosting, you get back up to 100%. So this was the regime that was going to go into the clinic last August when the outbreak broke and everything else was rethought. One more observation on mechanism. This is all the work of Nancy Sullivan's lab at the NIH in the US. After she vaccinated her monkeys, she depleted their CD8 T cells. And you can see that protection, even on small numbers here, is nearly completely ablated. So it looks like CD8 T cells are what is responsible for the protection. And consistent with that, she took the sera from the vaccinated animals, transferred it into other animals, infected them, and they were infected. So there's no protection obvious from antibodies. The second vaccine, the vesicular stomatitis virus, different viral vector, same approach. Glycoprotein from the surface of the virus encoded in the viral vector. Again, that had been shown to be effective as a single dose in macaques in Canada. An interesting viral vector, never really used much before, replication competent. It grows in your arm, gets into your blood, gives you a viremia for a couple of days, and developed by a tiny American company with the Canadians and then WHO and finally Merck. So what we ended up doing in a few weeks of fairly active discussion was create a partnership between WHO, ourselves doing the first clinical trial of the vaccine strain targeted at West Africa, funded by the Wellcome Trust with some other co-funders. GSK had bought out the little Italian biotech company that owned the chimpanzee adenoviruses. We'd been working on them with them for malaria. They'd been working with NIH for Ebola. So GSK suddenly had a candidate malaria vaccine. We decided to try and address two objectives. Could we show safety of these vaccines that had never been in humans before, say 100, 140 people, particularly healthcare workers who were the population most vulnerable in West Africa? Could we show safety in West Africa with collaborators in Bamako, in Mali? And then Trust Money also funded the manufacturing of the chimpanzee adenovirus at GSK. Initially 20,000 doses, they've made a lot more since then. And the goal, if you like, was by the end of December, this is less than 6 months later, to have shown safety, to have evaluated the immune responses and made a recommendation as to whether it was worth going any further, i.e. into a very large efficacy trial in Liberia with this vaccine. So it was a bit of a rush, to say the least. The first vaccination was by the middle of September, three different doses being assessed in 60 vaccinees at our centre at the Churchill. And very importantly, we were able to trigger the trial in Mali, and it was safety data in West Africa that WHO really wanted to see, by the 4th of October, just a few weeks later. I like showing this slide because I'll never show anything like it again, unfortunately. We wrote the grant application on the 14th of August and submitted it. We had an award letter 12 days later. That 12 days included reviewers' comments from six reviewers, my responses to those six reviewers in collaboration with my co-applicants, and decision processes at the Trust after that, and we were off by the 26th of August. Vaccine was filled a few days later. We had a regulatory application by the start of September, approved in a week by the MHRA. There wasn't, unfortunately, and if one thing went wrong, the whole thing was kiboshed, of course. You need everything in place to start the trial. The Ethics Committee wasn't meeting in September. It was meeting in early October. We pleaded, they held a special meeting and approved it pretty well the same day. Vaccine was shipped, the vaccine was labelled at our manufacturing facility. The contracts, as always, were rate limiting between all the lawyers in all the different centres, but we managed to start vaccinating pretty soon afterwards in September and finished by November. This slide is just to point out where we were partnering. We had to choose very quickly where the trial was going to be. We chose the Gambia. The president of the Gambia disagreed. He didn't want the word Gambia and Ebola in any sentence in the international media, so said, nope, you can't do your Ebola vaccine trial here. Luckily, we were able to work in Bamako in Mali, which is pretty close to the affected areas. There were cases crossing the border. Fantastic team there, led by Samba Sow, collaborating with the University of Maryland. We had quite a good choice. This is Ouagadougou, where we work a lot on malaria. Could have done it there. Clinic in the Gambia you've seen already. But we ended up in Bamako with a vaccine, of course, being experimental, it always has a label that's larger than the vaccine. We have people vaccinating with goggles for genetically modified organism vaccines, which these are. And of course, we look after these volunteers incredibly carefully because the whole point is to document safety. So if any of you wrote to me saying you were off to Ghana and could you possibly have a dose of Ebola vaccine, the reason the answer was no was, of course, that we have to follow people very carefully indeed over 6 months. And people volunteered fantastically, not in their tens, but in their hundreds. We were hugely oversubscribed by the day we were officially allowed to advertise. That won't happen again. Thanks to people's real concern and, of course, the publicity in the media. But we do need to document safety very carefully indeed for 7, 8, 9 visits in these trials. Did that, and the good news is, as we kind of expected, we'd used these viral vectors before for hepatitis C here in Oxford. The technology was safe. 60 people in Oxford, 91 in Mali, over 100 in Switzerland, starting soon afterwards, 20 in the US. The usual mild to moderate side effects, arm soreness. 2 people had a fever out of 60, so well tolerated. More importantly, we were measuring immune responses. I mean, what have you got to go on? You're going to vaccinate tens of thousands of people in West Africa, you have monkey data. You know the immune response that's required in monkeys to protect them against Ebola challenge. So the simple question we were asking was, could we reproduce those immune responses in people? If so, it would have been great. Different doses of the vaccine, most people respond, 70, 75, 93% at the higher dose. The level we could measure with an ELISA assay, unfortunately, the level was about tenfold down on what we were seeing in the monkeys. And that caused some discussion. There were the optimists who said, well, you're giving the monkeys a huge challenge dose. If you give that to people, a few hundred will be fine. They're only rubbing shoulders with other people. They'll have a low dose. Well, maybe, but I don't know. And in fact, nobody knows. The only way you can find out is testing the vaccine. So what we wanted to do was to see, well, what about cellular immunity? Remember, we thought CD8 T cells looked the best correlate in the monkeys. We can measure those by ELISpot or flow cytometry. I won't burden you with the details, but again, everybody responded at some level, all flavors of T cells as before, and importantly, quantifying the number of CD8 T cells, it was a bit low. Again, 0.07%, maybe a fifth, maybe a tenth of what you saw in the monkeys. So what we did won't surprise you now, knowing what we do in Oxford with booster vaccines. We looked around for an MVA. There was one at the NIH. They weren't keen to play. We knew MVA would be pretty safe because over 5,000 people had been immunized with an MVA vector. And luckily, one was available in Copenhagen. A small biotech company called Bavarian Nordic had been funded by the NIH on a biodefense program to make MVA with several antigens in, so a good vector, and they said, yes, you can have it and use it to boost your volunteers. At the same time, we worked to manufacture, with a lot of trust funding, the matching MVA from the Zaire strain of Ebola virus, managed to make 30,000 doses by February, and that's now available for much larger trials in West Africa. We invited back 30 of our excellent 60 volunteers. They all said yes. They all came back to the day. We boosted them with MVA. Luckily, the safety was as usual and fine. And the scale here on the antibodies now is different. There's day zero. There's after the adenovirus, barely detectable on this different y-axis. And there is 2 weeks after MVA. So it goes up about sevenfold compared to what you get with adenovirus alone. And now you have antibody levels that are seen in protected macaques. You have neutralizing antibodies at high titer after the MVA, very low after the adenovirus alone. And again, you're actually at higher levels than in protected macaques here with neutralization. And the T cells, as usual, boost up to very high levels on ELISpot, or if you measure by flow cytometry, the best measure of CD8 T cell numbers, there is after the prime, a rather low level, there is after the boost, 7 days afterwards, a much higher level. So that, to us, looks like the best regime for reproducing strong immunity. Can you do it faster? We usually give 8 weeks between the adenovirus and the MVA. In an outbreak, that's 8 weeks too long, or at least 7 weeks too long. Luckily, we had different intervals between priming and boosting. They didn't seem to make a difference. And just in the last few weeks, we've shown that a one-week prime-boost interval is fine. So that may be the most deployable regime. Meanwhile, a different company, Johnson & Johnson, from Belgium, owning Janssen, had come in with a different regime, adeno-26, a different adenovirus, MVA, same MVA. They said, we are doing this prime-boost regime, no faffing about with adenovirus only. Came to Oxford, and Matthew Snape in the pediatrics department has not only started this trial in December, he's now pretty well finished it. So that regime is ready to go as well. And meanwhile, the VSV people had been progressing very rapidly with their own vaccine. 5 different sites, Switzerland, USA, Gabon, Khalifi again in Kenya, Germany, Hamburg. They had a bit more reactogenicity as expected. Fever in a third of people, mild arthritis in some in Geneva, less so at other sites. But this has gone forward as well to West Africa. We have finally, in the last month, been able to compare from a paper in the New England Journal of VSV compared to our New England Journal of Medicine paper. They're about the same in antibodies, comparing the chimp adeno to the VSV. If you boost with MVA, of course, it goes up nearly tenfold. So that is a much better regime than VSV alone. So we made the target, which was to be ready in January for a large-scale trial in Liberia. 9,000 people with the chimp adeno vaccine, 9,000 people with the VSV vaccine, and 9,000 people receiving placebo, very controversially. Lots of discussion. In an outbreak setting, could you really bring people into a trial and give them an irrelevant placebo control? The decision was yes. The regulators strongly agreed. This trial is ongoing. It's blinded. Obviously, you're comparing rates of disease in placebo and vaccinees, but you won't get much of an answer in Liberia. There's the epidemic curve. It's gone right down in Liberia. It's not going down as much as you would like in Guinea, and it's going down in Sierra Leone. So this is a summary of what was planned at the beginning of this year. The big trial in Liberia, 8,000 healthcare workers in Sierra Leone. That's not really happened. It's been a very complex trial I won't bore you with. The most interesting trial is now in Guinea. not doing a traditional randomized control trial where you take 10,000 people, randomize them to one or the other. You follow the cases. Where there's a case in a village, you rush out with your team, ring vaccinate around the case to try and protect the others around that individual, or you delay vaccination. And the delayed group are the control group. And that is happening for the VSV vaccine, and we hope the Chad MVA, which is slated for the next trial there, will follow suit. But as I said, we won't get an answer in Liberia. There have been no cases in the last few weeks. Not much better chances in Sierra Leone, 12 cases last week. Guinea, probably best for not just because there are more cases, but because people are testing ring vaccination, which is more suited to the end of an outbreak. But of course, we don't really know how acceptable that is yet. It's looking okay so far, and high vaccine efficacy will make it easier to see significant results. So what do we do if we're too late? And we may well be. There is another route, not often used, where you use animal data to show efficacy. You find the immune correlates in animals. You demonstrate in clinical trials that you can get that immune response, as I've been talking about, and show that you have an adequate safety database, not in tens or hundreds of people, but in thousands. So what we've done here in Ebola is gone from phase 1 to phase 3, skipping the phase 2 large safety trials in the middle, and plan to do those after phase 3, which is, to say the least, unusual, but I think probably reasonable in the setting. And of course, we're not just trying to control this outbreak. Luckily, that may be going away on its own, maybe. But crucially, we need a vaccine for the next outbreak. But to finish, a few words, stepping back, literally. What we're doing is a rapid response. We shouldn't need to do this. We should be prepared. And it's not just Ebola, as I told you earlier. There are 15 viruses, some bacteria as well, 15 viruses on this slide that have caused outbreaks in humans in the last decade or so. Some of them you know well, SARS, huge panic, West Nile in the United States, so on and so forth. There is no licensed human vaccine for any of these. If there's an outbreak next month of any of these, there's a problem. Will there be more major outbreaks? Well, you don't have to know a great deal about demography and sociology and epidemiology to think the answer is probably yes. There are more people, especially in Africa, highest growth rates, bigger cities. This virus got into Conakry and other big cities, certainly more long distance travel. People are richer in Africa than they were. That's not very rich, but there's more travel. Viruses will move around more, many viruses lurking, mainly in bats. We think bats are the reservoir for this virus, possibly. And these are Mr. Cheney's known knowns. There are unknowns as well. If they're as bad as SARS and they're aerosol transmitted, they really are a problem. So, second last slide, a suggested way forward, a modest proposal. We could do what we've done for Ebola, for these other pathogens. Take those preclinical candidates, they exist, they've all been tested in mice, they're sitting there as research papers, actually make the vaccines to GMP, do a small phase 1 or 2 or a few phase 1 trials to show safety, just as we've done in Ebola, and have the vaccine ready as a small stockpile for the next outbreak. Then when the outbreak comes, you can test its efficacy. If we had a lot in Guinea a year ago, we'd probably have curbed the outbreak. So vaccine stockpiles, ideally held in affected regions. You don't need a million doses. 10,000 to 50,000 would be fine. You will get emergency approvals, and you will be able to evaluate efficacy. And this is not a new idea. It's done a lot, actually, in veterinary vaccines. Some of you know we have stockpiles of foot and mouth disease vaccine. Why don't we have stockpiles of vaccines that might kill us? And luckily, we know the cost of doing this. We've just done it for Ebola. It is millions, but it's not hundreds of millions. And Ebola has cost best part of probably 5 billion. So you could make them all to this level for a fraction of the cost of what Ebola has cost the world. It does help if you have a common manufacturing platform. I've described one to you. There are a few options. So in conclusion on Ebola, rapid clinical trial responses to outbreak pathogens are possible, but even so, maybe too late. We may be this time. Many viral threats exist against which we have no human vaccines, and essentially all of those come from animals. They're zoonotic. And we need a new strategy to develop these vaccines. We have a category of vaccines, they're mainly helminths, that are called neglected. tropical diseases, which we should have vaccines for. These pathogens didn't even make that list of neglected ones. So I guess they're kind of super neglected. And a reason, of course, is that there is no business case for a big pharma company to make a vaccine against an outbreak that might never happen again. We need a new model. We need public funding, foundation funding. They're not the most difficult vaccines to make. And I think it's time to do something. So I will leave it at that, acknowledge the many people in Oxford and our collaborators who've been involved in this accelerated response. I won't read through them, I'll leave the slide up, and particularly thank our funders for funding us in an exceptionally rapid manner. Thank you for your attention.